Hello, welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, May 3. I'm your reader, Kathleen. Our first article from the front page, FEMA denies majority of derecho aid requests. This is a Washington Post story. On the morning Kim Schmadeke decided to make a final plea to the U.S. government for help, she peered out through drawn windows at her battered neighborhood. Trees on the ground, tarps over roofs. More tarps over shredded sides of homes, all remnants of a freak inland hurricane that blew through August 10, 2020, tore down half the trees and damaged 90% of the city's homes. It was a brutal storm that was especially damaging to mobile home parks, such as Kirkwood Estates, where Schmadeke lived and where 7 months later, she was the last person who had not given up on getting help. Washington officials vowed in the days after the disaster, "This ordeal is wreaking havoc on my life," she began, typing on her computer, beneath a buckling ceiling. On the floor were tubs marking the areas too soggy to step. In the bathroom, the toilet was tilting because of the rotting floor, and the shower had stopped working, leaving her to clean herself up at the kitchen sink. She read back what she had typed, imagined how the words would sound to the people she was sending them to at the Federal Emergency Management Agency. "Does that sound stupid?" she asked. "And was the correct word wreaking? Was it wrecking? This ordeal is causing me much mental anguish," she retyped. This was her third attempt to get help from the country's rescue team against natural disasters, which, as extreme weather events proliferate, has also become its de facto rescue team against climate change. Amid predictions of more storms, fires, and floods, one of the first things President Joe Biden did after taking office was give FEMA a bigger mandate, starting with an initiative to steer billions of dollars toward protecting against climate disasters before they strike. But the reality is that even as millions of Americans will be turning to FEMA as disasters worsen, the agency has grown significantly more restrictive with the help it gives out. Iowa is one indication of this. According to FEMA data, 22,000 people applied for aid and 19,000 received notices telling them that they were not eligible. Of those 19,000, Schmadeke was among the few hundred who did not take that initial no for an answer. And now, even though she knew that most people who appealed were turned down again, she set her mind to persuading the agency that she needed its support. "The damage to my home is mounting," she typed. "I have mold growing, water running down the walls, and my front door will barely open and shut. On top of that, my toilet is sinking into the floor." She kept typing. "Please stop playing games with me," she wrote, and deleted because it might sound angry. "I feel like I have been left out to dry and am spinning in circles," she wrote, and kept going for more than an hour. She finished and reread what she had written. "That's a good letter," she said. The agency she was writing to is one of the most crucial in times of American need. It has a budget of $24 billion and has had the same mission for 42 years, helping people before, during, and after disasters. FEMA was created after earthquakes and hurricanes made it clear that the country needed a way to coordinate emergency responses. It has grown to become the bulwark against the United States' worsening climate crisis, with major programs that provide temporary housing and grants to disaster survivors. Independent reviews have showed that it is not an agency that succeeds in helping everyone equally. Last year, an advisory council set up by Congress found that key FEMA programs are less accessible to disadvantaged Americans, especially poor people, and that the more aid a place receives after a disaster, the more unequal it becomes as it recovers. Through the entire disaster cycle, communities that have been underserved stay underserved, and thereby suffer needlessly and unjustly, the council wrote. The council mentioned the Individual Assistance Program, which helps homeowners without adequate insurance rebuild after federal disasters. FEMA used to approve about two-thirds of applicants, but that changed after the agency came under criticism for letting fraud slip through in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. In recent years, the program's approval rates have plummeted. 6 million households applied for help between 2017 and 2020, and FEMA sent rejections to 4 million of them. In 2021, FEMA has approved 13% of applicants. its lowest rate yet. In a news release late last month, FEMA said it approved 3,084 households for more than $11.2 million in individual assistance grants after the derecho. It said the aid is for basic home repairs and temporary housing assistance, but noted FEMA is prohibited from duplicating insurance payments or aid from other programs or organizations. Fortunately, most Iowa homeowners, renters, business owners, and farmers have insurance coverage for severe wind damage. Private insurance has paid more than $1.6 billion in claims as of November 2020, according to state data, the agency said in a statement. What we do strive for is to provide financial assistance that can help make a home safe and secure and habitable, said Chris Smith, who directs the FEMA program. This was the program's directive on August 10, 2020, when a massive complex of thunderclouds began to gather in South Dakota on a morning that had been forecast to be clear and sunny. The sudden windstorm raced into Iowa, gathering strength as it went. By the time it darkened the noontime skies over the eastern part of the state, it was moving faster than Hurricane Sandy or Hurricane Harvey, with winds reaching 140 miles per hour. The derecho tore through the state's farmland, unwrapping metal silos, picking up and throwing tractors, and flattening millions of acres of drought-parched corn before growing stronger still and crashing into homes and apartments in Cedar Rapids, including the mobile home Schmadeke had been taking meticulous care of for two decades. 60 years old now, Schmadeke had bought the trailer when she was 38, with money she saved during a short-lived program or job with the U.S. Postal Service. Until then, she and her daughter had been bouncing between two low-rent apartments. With its two bedrooms, pineapple stamped wallpaper, and small yard where Schmadeke planted flowers, the trailer was life-changing, as she put it. We moved so much, and when we moved in, it just gave us stability, she said. Her daughter lived there until she went to college, and after that, Schmadeke had lived a most solitary life. When the storm rushed in, she found herself unable to stand without being knocked over. She lay gripping the couch cushions, listening to tree branches crack and bang against her roof. In a matter of minutes, her home was ruined. She remembers seeing water streaming down the walls. She remembers opening the door and seeing streets covered in torn insulation and smashed car windows. The following night, Schmadeke was taken to a hospital and diagnosed with a panic attack, her heart racing as she worried over how she would fix everything. The power stayed out for days. When it came back on, she found out Cedar Rapids had been declared a federal disaster area, making her eligible for up to $71,000 in individual assistance aid. She applied immediately and received a response the next day. Assistance not approved, it began. Twice more she saw the word ineligible, then realized it was because the agency's automated system had not found proof in public records that she owned her home. So she wrote an appeal, a choice 3% of FEMA applicants make. After a few weeks, she got another letter. There was no explanation this time, just a check for $48, which was followed a few days later by another check for $1,312, also without an explanation. She appealed again, saying the money was not nearly enough to cover her damage, and that resulted in another check, again with no explanation, for $2,036. But the contractors had said it would cost $9,400 to fix the roof and bathroom alone. Schmadeke guessed at what FEMA wanted her to do with the money. She got the branches removed, replaced the insulation so her water pipes wouldn't freeze, and had the trailer put back on its foundation to stop shaking. The money would not stretch far enough to fix the bathroom, though, and it was long gone by the time she was sitting at her desk with her finished appeal letter. It had been 5 days since Schmadeke had sent in her latest appeal, and on the sixth day she found an internet shutoff notice in her mailbox and called the company. I've never missed a payment, and the one time I'm late you're going to shut me off, she said. The representative agreed to give her a few more days, and Schmadeke put the letter next to the overdue car insurance bill and water bill, which had tripled since her toilet began leaking after the storm. At the one-week mark, she was back at work and got lucky with a $108 taxi fare. Internet paid, insurance paid, water bill paid. That's something, she said. But day after day was the same. Wake up, clean yourself at the kitchen sink, check the FEMA site, check the mail, go to work, watch a show. Then came the 26th day when Schmadeke checked the FEMA site and saw a letter waiting for her. Assistance not approved, it began. She read it slowly, then read it again, looking for a reason and seeing nothing except that she had received all eligible assistance for this type of loss. Despite everything, part of her had believed that the agency would give her more help, but now she was not going to write to FEMA anymore. She was done. Also on the front page, this story by Michaela Ram, Mercy to Build Comprehensive Heart Center. Mercy Medical Center has announced plans for a new cardiovascular care center as part of the hospital's goal to expand its heart program. Hospital officials have not released the cost to rebuild the 72,000 square foot facility. Hospital officials have not released the cost to build the 72,000 square foot facility at 9th Street Southeast and 8th Avenue Southeast in downtown Cedar Rapids, across the street from Mercy's main hospital entrance. It is expected to open sometime in mid-2023. The Heart Center will house Mercy's medical care under one roof, said Dr. Timothy Quinn, Chief of Medical Operations at Mercy. Various services across the continuum of care, from prevention and screening to actual diagnosis and treatment, are now housed across multiple locations. The underlying theme of all this, much like when we built the Cancer Center, is elevation of the level of care for the entire community, Quinn said. Construction is scheduled to begin in the fall. Additional project details will be announced as the plan moves forward, including the name of the donor behind the extraordinarily generous estate gift funding the project. Mercy officials did not disclose the size of the donation to the Gazette. Officials described development of the Heart Center as a natural progression of the tremendous growth in its heart program in recent years, from the increasing number of cardiac patients from Cedar Rapids and outlying communities. Over the course of many years, we've focused on establishing the area's leading heart program, emphasizing quality outcomes, increasing access, enhancing the patient experience, and advancing technology and procedures, Tim Charles, Mercy's president and CEO, said in a statement. With the growth we've experienced, now is the time for this next step as we combine our efforts into a new heart center and bring our resources under one roof. The facility will accommodate that growth and allow officials to continue adding to the program, Dr. C.C. Lee, co-medical director of the Heart Center at Mercy, said in the statement. In the long term, the facility plans are designed for vertical expansion, opening the door for further development. That can include additional electrophysiology, cardiac catheterization labs, and surgical suites now available in the main hospital location, officials said. As new technologies become available, future growth is likely to include more outpatient services, Quinn said. Expansion of the heart program includes hiring a new cardiothoracic surgeon who will start later this summer. Mercy officials still are determining the number of new hires with the facility. Mercy also will increase the number of specialty clinics, including clinics for heart failure, atrial fibrillation, and heart valve disorders. Quinn pointed to cardio-oncology as an example of an existing specialty clinic at Mercy. Providers established the clinic after they found a substantial number of post-cancer care patients go on to suffer from vascular disease in later years, most likely due to the cancer-related medications that increase the risk of heart disease. Mercy's multidisciplinary teams also are developing a follow-up clinic for patients recovering from COVID-19. Quinn said providers have found a number of these patients had undetected heart failure, but began showing symptoms after they were infected with the virus. Plans for the Heart Center also include increased heart screenings and early detection services, community education space for cardiopulmonary resuscitation, and automated external defibrillator training and similar programming. We're really excited about the potential for these types of patient engagement, said Dr. Ryan Hollenbeck, co-medical director of the Heart Center at Mercy. The announcement of the Heart Center at Mercy comes about 5 years after the hospital received state approval to launch an open-heart surgery program. At the time, Mercy officials said it transferred 150 people each year to other facilities for cardiac procedures. Unity Point Health, St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids, which has a cardiovascular surgical program, opposed the new program. Moving to the Iowa Today page, this story by Lee Hermiston, a fatal Johnson County plane crash under investigation. The Johnson County Sheriff's Office is investigating a fatal plane crash. According to a news release, deputies were called at 3:52 p.m. Sunday to 250th Street and Greencastle Avenue Northwest in rural Tiffin. Witnesses reported seeing an airplane near the Greencastle Airport and later seeing it crash into a nearby field. The name of the pilot is being withheld until the family can be notified. The Federal Aviation Administration and National Transportation Safety Board will be joining the investigation, according to the Sheriff's Office. Also on the Iowa Today page, an Iowa City man accused of interfering with a homicide investigation. This story also by Lee Hermiston. A local one-time Black Lives Matter movement leader whose apartment was the site of a fatal shooting tried to deter the investigation, police said. Quincy Russom, age 19, was found dead inside 615 South Governor Street, number 6, the home of 20-year-old Mazen M. Muhammad Ali, at 7:53 p.m. February 1. Police said 30 minutes transpired between the time Russom was killed and the time police were notified. In a new criminal complaint, police allege Muhammad Ali had specific knowledge that Sammy Hamed, age 22, had murdered Russom and waited to call 911. Police said Muhammad Ali lied during questioning, gave false descriptions of people involved, and withheld other information that would have led police to Hamed more quickly. Hamed was arrested later that month and faces a first-degree murder charge. The criminal complaint alleges Muhammad Ali deleted his call history and Snapchat from his phone. In a recorded conversation, Muhammad Ali allegedly admitted to lying to police about the homicide and who was involved so police would not find out about the origin of guns tied to the investigation, police said. Muhammad Ali faces one count of accessory after the fact, an aggravated misdemeanor. Muhammad Ali was previously arrested on charges that spun out of the original homicide investigation. Police served a search warrant February 24th at his apartment and found 56.13 grams of marijuana in his closet and 42.5 ecstasy pills. He was arrested on two counts each of controlled substance violation and Iowa drug tax stamp violation and one count of keeping a drug house. He's scheduled to go to trial August 24. Muhammad Ali was arrested Saturday and released from the Johnson County Jail later that day, according to jail records. Also on the Iowa Today page, not a story included, but quite a few photos. Chalk it up to a good time. Mount Vernon hosted Sidewalk Art Festival that returned after the hiatus, and there are several photos of different people who were involved in chalking the walk in Mount Vernon. Moving now to the Insight page, the editorial today is from Jonah Goldberg, a syndicated columnist, and it's titled Biden's Superpower. Boring. Joe Biden's first 100 days as president went into the books Friday, and one thing is clear, boring is a superpower. But first, let's start by noting that the whole first 100 days thing is a pseudo-event that's only a big deal because politicians and journalists agreed to make it one, starting with Franklin D. Roosevelt. But it's become a de facto deadline for the same crowd to talk about whether the president is off to a good start. Not coincidentally, pollsters for NBC News asked that very question. 16% say Biden has had a great start. 28% call it a good start, 21% say it's only been fair, and 34% say poor. Critics want to add the fair start to the poor start to claim that he's not doing well. Boosters want to add the fair respondents to the great, and good columns to claim he's knocking it out of the park. Unfortunately for both, that fair start crowd is probably split between those who wanted him to do more and those who wanted him to do less. That would explain why his approval rating in both the NBC poll and the Real Clear Politics average is 53%. That's good compared with Donald Trump at 42% and Gerald Ford at 48%. But historically, it's near the bottom. It's unclear whether history is a useful yardstick. The rise in polarization and partisanship has no analog in the modern era of polling, so it shouldn't shock us Biden can't compete with historic benchmarks. Far more important, the polling is irrelevant to how historians will gauge Biden's first 100 days. Historians measure the quantity of things done, though some historians will argue that quality is their lodestar. On that score, Biden is off to a great start. I say that even though I disagree with much of what he has done and is trying to do, but if you just count up the amount of money spent, programs launched, and executive orders issued or rescinded, there's been an extraordinary amount of energy in the executive, to borrow a phrase from Alexander Hamilton, which is ironic for such a lower energy president, as Donald Trump might say. That brings us to Biden's superpower. He's boring. This is a remarkable transformation, given that for most of his career, Biden has been one of the most attention-hungry politicians in American life. A gaffe machine, as he has described himself. Several factors probably explain this. He's mellowed in his old age, having gotten the job he sought for decades. Perhaps he no longer sees the point in setting his hair on fire to get attention and respect. Or he recognizes that after 4 years of an unpopular president alienating a majority of voters, staying above the fray of polarizing issues is the best way to cobble together a majority coalition. But as Jonathan Chait of New York Magazine notes, being personally boring doesn't necessarily translate into a boring agenda. Biden is on a path to enlarge government's role in American life, borrowing trillions to do it in ways not seen since Lyndon B. Johnson or FDR. It turns out that the modern liberal formula for political success, which in Chait's words saw popular mobilization as the highest form of political organization, was a mistake. Transformative policy agendas are harder to sell when you admit that's what you're doing because they invite a backlash from a coalition of the opposite party and the center. Biden has figured out, or stumbled into, a better formula. Push a fairly radical agenda while acting like grandpa. The base will be placated with the tangible results, while the more moderate middle, which tends to focus on tone and personality, won't get too worked up. The question is whether this formula can last. Biden had Trump fatigue, desperation for COVID-19 relief, and the vaccine rollout in his favor. Those issues may be receding in the rearview mirror. Meanwhile, issues that divide Americans and Biden's base in ways that create headaches for him are rising to the fore. Biden's approval ratings on China, 35%, guns, 34%, and border security and immigration, 33%, are signs that the road ahead will get rockier. When you're vaccinating Americans, sending them cash, and building infrastructure, particularly when Republicans are MIA, or talking about Dr. Seuss, it's easy to be inoffensive. The Biden administration's messaging has been successful at keeping divisive issues on the presidential back burner. Eventually, they will come to a sufficient boil, and his grandpa demeanor won't be enough. How he responds will be a better measure of his presidency than his first 100 days. And that's submitted by Jonah Goldberg, editor-in-chief of The Dispatch and host of The Remnant podcast. And our guest column is by Lisa Grave today. She's a syndicated columnist. Do not shield more dark money. On April 26, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case that could unmoor decades of transparency laws, even as dark money spending by special interests continues to rise. The court's new majority is being asked by billionaire Charles Koch's nonprofits to expand on the notion that money is speech, by ruling that the First Amendment bars disclosure laws that may chill large donors from giving more money to nonprofits. On the surface, the case known as Americans for Prosperity Foundation versus Bonta is about whether a state can require a nonprofit group to reveal a list of its donors who give $5,000 or more. That data is not public, but a glitch in California's electronic filing system inadvertently made it searchable to other filers for a short period. There is no evidence it was misused or abused by regulators or others, and the California flaw was fixed. But that was not good enough for Koch's Americans for Prosperity, which apparently had been refusing to provide that data to California anyway, even though it was required by the IRS. The IRS has allowed nonprofits to redact the names but requires public disclosure of the largest amounts. This rule is the only reason we know, for example, that a group called the Wellspring Committee received almost all of its funding, more than $28 million, from a single unknown donor after Justice Antonin Scalia died in February 2016. Between 2016 and 2017, Wellspring gave a total of $38 million to a group called the Judicial Crisis Network, which spent millions to pressure the Senate to block President Barack Obama's nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court, Merrick Garland, and then to push for the confirmation of President Donald Trump nominees Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. The case before the Supreme Court continues Koch's assault on even minimal transparency and oversight of nonprofits. Koch has helped raise and spend more than $1 billion to influence elections, but the donors are kept hidden. That is why spending through such groups like Americans for Prosperity is so robust. Unlike money donated directly to a candidate or political party, donations to groups like Americans for Prosperity are secret. Americans for Prosperity has taken credit for spending millions to help GOP candidates win elections and to get Trump-appointed judges confirmed. That includes helping Amy Coney Barrett get confirmed right before the 2020 election, which is why Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, a Democrat from Rhode Island, and others asked that she recuse herself from hearing the case. Barrett refused. But now, Justices Barrett, Kavanaugh, and Gorsuch are poised to aid the agenda of the dark money groups that help sweep them into and onto the Supreme Court. They may even strike a fatal blow against disclosure laws, like H.R. 1, the For the People Act, which would shine a light on billionaires like Koch. Our democracy desperately needs more sunshine, not more darkness. And again, that's submitted by Lisa Graves, who is the executive director of True North Research and former deputy assistant attorney general in the Office of Legal Policy at the U.S. Department of Justice. We have three community letters today. The first, these are not the actions of a conservative government. The Iowa legislature has passed a bill that would financially protect people driving cars into crowds of protesters. Interesting. They are now considering a bill that would penalize businesses requiring vaccine passports to deal with them. I know there can be various kind of vaccine passports, some I might like and others not, but why is the state injecting itself into businesses like this? This is all pretty radical, revolutionary. I guess we don't actually have a conservative state government in Iowa anymore. And that's signed by Hal Denderant from Lisbon. Our next letter, global health needs to extend beyond COVID-19. This year, many young Americans experienced vaccine inaccessibility for the first time in their lives while waiting to become eligible for a COVID-19 vaccine. Luckily, we didn't have to wait long and vaccines became readily accessible to all U.S. residents 16 and older just 5 months after the Food and Drug Administration issued an emergency use authorization for the first vaccine against COVID-19. Unfortunately, for many adults and children around the world, lack of vaccine access remains a significant barrier to improved health and well-being. As the COVAX program works to provide equitable global access to coronavirus vaccines and global immunity to COVID-19 slowly comes into view, It's important to remain vigilant in our global health efforts. Routine childhood immunizations for diseases like measles and polio experienced significant disruption when the pandemic forced more than 68 countries to delay, postpone, and suspend immunization programs, leaving millions of children at risk. Global health funding for global vaccination programs like GAVI, the Vaccine Alliance, and UNICEF is a cost-effective investment that saves the lives of children and supports the development of robust health systems that can aid in the fight against future global health crises. Join me in calling on U.S. Representatives Ashley Hinson and Marionette Miller Meeks and U.S. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst to support continued funding for global health programs that play a role in administering childhood vaccines around the world. That's signed by Katarina Newcamp of Iowa City. And finally, how to help those with an aversion to needles. When I was 10 years old, I had a life-saving radical mastoidectomy. Following that surgery, I had to have a penicillin shot every day for almost a month, and yes, they hurt. Now, that was 1950, and the technology was much different from what it is today. Nevertheless, I cannot bring myself to watch the endless display of needles going into arms. I don't know this for a fact, but I suspect that there are many people who share my aversion to needles. I have had both of my vaccinations, and they were virtually painless, which I think needs to be the point made in addressing the vaccine aversion problem. Stop with all the needle pictures and simply have statements about the insignificant discomfort. I think this will help with the aversion problem and will certainly make my TV watching more enjoyable. That is signed by Gordon Taylor of Anamosa. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, May 3, on IRIS. And now we turn to today's obituaries. In the short notices from Cedar Rapids, Michael W. Robertson, Jr., age 28, died Friday, April 30, Papich Kuba Funeral Service, Cedar Rapids. Also in Cedar Rapids, Joseph William Yanda, age 75, died Saturday, May 1, Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Cedar Rapids. In Hiawatha, Michael, known as Mike Higgins, age 62, died Saturday, May 1, Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home, Cedar Rapids. In Manchester, Richard Ingalls, age 70, of Oneida, died Saturday, May 1. Leonard Muller Funeral Home and Crematory, Manchester, is in charge. In Maynard, Norma L. Glue, age 91, died Saturday, May 1. Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home, Olwine. In Monona, Julius Edward Detman, age 90, died Saturday, May 1. The Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Monona is assisting. From West Branch, Regina, known as Jean Abel, age 86, died Saturday, May 1. Henderson Barker Funeral Home, West Branch. And in Westgate, Anna E. Kane, age 93, died Friday, April 30. Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home, Olwine. And in other deaths, Dallas Jordan Thompson, age 31, of Clinton, formerly of Monona, died Saturday, May 1. The Leonard Grau Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Monona is assisting. Moving now to the regular notices from Anamosa, Charles, known as Chuck William Heskett, age 78, of Anamosa, passed away April 29. A private graveside service will take place at Riverside Cemetery in Anamosa. A celebration of life will take place 2:30 p.m. Saturday, May 22nd, at the Bowhunters Club in Anamosa. From East Amana, Shirley F. Childers, age 79, of East Amana, passed away at her home Saturday, May 1. Graveside service will be at 11 a.m. Tuesday, May 4, at the East Amana Cemetery, with Elder Tony Berger officiating. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be sent to Closter Funeral Home in care of Shirley, 298 West Washington Street, Marengo, 52301. From Cascade, Herbert John, known as Cubby Manternack, age 69, passed away with his children by his side April 30 after a long battle with chronic illness. Family will greet friends from 10 to 11 Tuesday, May 4 at St. Martin's Catholic Church in Cascade. The Reef Funeral Home is assisting the family with arrangements. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to Camp Courageous. Anyone wishing to send a memorial can send it to the Reef Funeral Home, Attingent Herb Manternack Family, P.O. Box 430, Cascade, 52033. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Tuesday, May 4, at St. Martin's Church in Cascade, with the Reverend Mark Osterhaus presiding. Services will be live-streamed at 11 a.m. on the St. Thomas Aquinas Pastorate Facebook page. Burial will be at Calvary Cemetery in Cascade. From Cedar Rapids, Marty Brick, age 62, passed away Friday, April 30, at Living Center West. Marty was preceded in death by his parents, and at his request, he will be cremated, and there will be no services. IowaCremation.com is in charge of arrangements. From Williamsburg, Ethel Anna Sophia Newkirk passed away May 1 at the Compass Medical Health Memorial Healthcare Center in Marengo at the age of 92. Celebration of life service will be at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, May 4, at the St. Paul Lutheran Church in Williamsburg. Burial will be at the St. Paul Lutheran Cemetery in Williamsburg. Visitation will be Monday from 4 to 7 at the Powell Funeral Home. A memorial fund has been established at the St. Paul Lutheran Church Altar Guild or Women's Guild. Powell Funeral Homes is in charge of arrangements. From Cedar Rapids, Betty Mae Carney, age 86, passed away Friday, April 30, at the Dennis and Donna Oldorf Hospice House of Mercy. As per the family's wishes, private family interment will be at a later date in Cedar Memorial Cemetery. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Cedar Rapids is in charge of arrangements. Also in Cedar Rapids, Georgiana Nevins, age 97, passed away Friday, April 30, at the Mechanicsville Specialty Care in Mechanicsville. A private graveside service will be held at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. And from Maynard, Norma L. Glue, age 91, formerly of Maynard and Olwine, died Saturday, May 1st at the Rehabilitation Center of Lisbon with her family at her side. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Thursday, May 6th at Christ United Presbyterian Church, Olwine. Visitation will be at 9:30 to 11 Thursday at the church. Interment at the Long Grove Cemetery in Maynard. Jameson Schmidt's Funeral Home, Olwine, is assisting the family. A memorial fund has been established. Condolences may be directed to Julie Kester, 5001 31st Avenue in Walker, 52352. And an online obituary is available at the jamesonschmidtsfuneralhome.com website. Moving now to the sports page, this story by J.R. Ogden. Steers was one-of-a-kind coach and person. One of the best things about this job is the people you meet. There's the athletes you watch grow up, some lucky enough to get to that next level and shine in college and sometimes beyond, or the many more who simply shine in other aspects of life. There's the coaches, too, the men and women who mold the aforementioned athletes into stars or simply into better people. Al Steers was in the latter group, a man who molded as much as he coached during his long career at Cedar Rapids Kennedy. It didn't matter to Steers if you were the star of the team or someone looking to find their place. You shined in his eyes. He accepted everybody, said Dennis Roloff, who ran against Steers' committee as a high school standout in Cedar Rapids, Jefferson, in the early 70s, and later coached at Kennedy. Steers died April 22nd at the age of 86. A celebration of life will be held later this summer at Lovely Lane Methodist Church in Cedar Rapids. I met Al while covering high school track for the Gazette, but he remembered me from my days running track at Cedar Rapids, Washington. Al had a passion for his athletes and a deep love of track and field, something we had in common. We'd sit at Kingston Stadium or Drake Stadium and just talk. Not interview, just talk. That can be rare in this business. He was a wonderful, wonderful person and will be dearly missed, Roloff said. Steers was born in Nemaha, Nebraska, and played football, basketball, baseball, and ran track at Nemaha High, where he also met his wife, Twyla. He played football at Peru State College, earning a degree in industrial arts and education. He received his master's in education at the University of South Dakota. After coaching in Nebraska, he headed east to coach at Sac City before finding his forever job and home in 1967 in Cedar Rapids. He was an assistant football coach at first, but became head coach in 1983, a job he held only a few years. He later served as the head sophomore coach. But it was track where Steers really left his mark. He was Kennedy's boys track and field coach from 1968 until he retired in 1997. I learned a lot from Al and Harold Wilkinson, Roloff said of Steers, and the Cougars' late girls track and field coach. They loved dealing with people and kids. Bill Pinckney was a sophomore football player, at Kennedy in the late 60s. He is one of those coaches who made a huge difference in my life, he said. Pinckney later returned to his alma mater to coach, then moved to the southeast side of town and coached Washington to state track titles in 2009 and 2010. He was kind of like a second dad to all of us, Pinckney said. He was one of a kind, a pleasure to be around all the time. Pinckney and Roloff talked a lot about Steer's constant positive attitude. He never appeared down and would always greet you with a warm smile. He had a positive influence on a multitude of people, probably without even knowing it. I include myself in that group. If you were with him and feeling down, he could turn you around in a split second, Pinckney said. Roloff said, you never heard a bad word from Steers, nor a negative response, or a swear word. He was always positive. He made the comment, it's too easy to swear. Roloff said Steers always did the right thing. I respected him a lot. Everyone needs a person like Al Steers in their life. Al is going to be missed, Pinckney said. Moving over now to the community page, here are the Eastern Iowa briefs for today. In Cedar Rapids, Gratitude Wall launches at Lindale. May is Mental Health Awareness Month. Today, from 11 to 1, the Wall of Gratitude will be launched at Lindale Mall in the food court area near Collins Road entrance. Join the celebration of mental health awareness by sharing hopeful messages on the wall and learning about community resources. The wall at Lindale Mall will remain on display through May and will be available for sharing thoughts of positivity and gratitude. People are encouraged to visit the Wall of Gratitude, take selfies, and share on social media using these hashtags. Hashtag NAMI Wall of Gratitude, hashtag Mental Health, and hashtag capital N, capital A, capital M, capital I. As a community-wide celebration, Walls of Gratitude will be launched at other locations in Cedar Rapids. Walls that are scheduled to be on display in May are at Abbey Center for Community Health and Unity Point Health. Details are available at namilincounty.org or emailing namilincounty@hotmail.com. And in Marion, Echo Hill Station dedication is Tuesday. The Marion East Cedar Rapids Rotary Club will dedicate its Echo Hill Station Low Park Art Walk project at 11 a.m. Tuesday. The public is welcome to attend. Inspired by the Arthur A. Collins Legacy Association, the Marion East Cedar Rapids Rotary Club set out to recognize its 50th anniversary and the 52nd anniversary this year of man's first steps on the moon by developing a fun, interactive art project on the Low Park Art Walk. The club also hopes to inspire youth to explore careers in science, technology, engineering, and math. The project commemorates the historic first transmission of an image by Collins Radio by bouncing a signal off the orbiting Echo 1 satellite from the Echo Hill Station near Low Park to the Collins facility in Richardson, Texas. That was on August 20, 1960. This accomplishment led to the future ability to communicate with and track manned space flights, including moon landings, as well as the development of deep space satellites and GPS. Members of local communities provided the knowledge and technical skills to accomplish these advances. The Rotary Club raised funds to provide 3 8-foot granite tablets telling the history, science, and legacy of those who made it possible. There are also 2 parabolic dishes that are 8 foot in diameter and 100 feet apart. The 100 feet represents the diameter of the Echo satellite. A person can whisper into one dish, and another person can hear it in the other dish. The third piece of the interactive art project is a replica of the Echo satellite. 6 feet in diameter, the stainless steel globe is located near the dishes. This event coincides with the release of the Arthur A. Collins Legacy Association's 3rd documentary film, Steps to the Moon, on Wednesday at Collins Road Theaters. In the film, Arthur Collins and his engineers described the historic moments in communication research that resulted in Collins radios and systems accompanying every Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo mission. Through these events, the Rotary thanks those who came before and ignited a curiosity in young people to consider a STEM career and to make sure this piece of local history is not lost. And also in an Eastern Iowa brief from Oxford, an open house on trail extension is Tuesday. The Johnson County Conservation Department will host a public open house Tuesday to discuss the upcoming Clear Creek Trail extension to F.W. Kent Park. The open house will be from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Conservation Education Center at F.W. Kent Park. Attendees will be requested to wear a mask while in the building. Staff from Stanley Consultants and Confluence will be on hand to exhibit route details and renderings from key components in the trail design. The trail corridor will require bridges, a potential underpass, retaining walls, and other aspects that the public will be able to comment on. The planning process is an important opportunity to gather input from the community. This open house is part of a comprehensive planning process that also includes representatives from the Iowa Department of Transportation, Johnson County Secondary Roads Department, Iowa Interstate Railroad, Johnson County Conservation Board, and Johnson County Conservation staff. The extension of the Clear Creek Trail to F.W. Kent Park will expand the ever-growing regional trail network connecting Iowa City, Coralville, Tiffin, and North Liberty with destination points that offer additional recreational opportunities and family experiences. Also on the community page is a photo of this kitty. Yowney is a 10-year-old female cat available for adoption at the Cedar Valley Humane Society, 7411 Mount Vernon Road Southeast, for a special fee of $45. Yowney is the pet of the week. Yowney loves watching birds lying on laps and giving hugs. She's scared of other cats and dogs, so she needs to go to a home with no other pets. The shelter is open by appointment only. You can call 319-362-6288 for more information. And again, that is the Cedar Valley Humane Society. Also on the community page, this story about art, Drawn Down Under, seen here. Exhibit brings art of Australia's outback to downtown Cedar Rapids. This story by Diana Nolan. Nearly 10,000 miles separate eastern Iowa and the Australian outback, but artistic themes unite them. Grant Wood, in the verdant heartland, and the indigenous people living in the Red Earth Desert half a world away have embraced the artistic beauty in the land beneath their feet and the pattern it evokes. And now people in Wood's territory can see the patterns from Australia in Dreamings, Australian Aboriginal Paintings. The exhibit features 31 recent works of acrylic paint on linen canvas, painstakingly created by the artists of a workshop and nearby indigenous village of Yuenduma and Yeripi in central Australia. The works are on view at least through June 21st in the ground floor gallery at the CRST corporate headquarters in downtown Cedar Rapids. They're hanging from scaffolding facing First Street Southeast and are easy to see day and night from the sidewalk or by appointment inside the gallery. All the pieces are for sale. Because the workshop pays its artists as pieces are completed, the funds raised through exhibit sales are channeled back into improving village life. The money has paid for a grocery store, a child care center, and even a vehicle that can be used for trips outside the villages. Janelle McLean, age 72, former owner of the Corner House Gallery in Cedar Rapids, with her husband George, curated the exhibit and arranged to have the pieces shipped to Cedar Rapids. So far, about half the pieces have been sold, with some buyers agreeing to keep their purchases on display during the exhibit. Prices range from $125 to $3,000 for the largest work, but the average is $200 to $500. Works taken to their home, new home, before the show closes will be replaced by other pieces shipped to Cedar Rapids. It's kind of an evolving exhibit, McLean said. She and her husband eventually will hand them off to their son, Logan, to exhibit and sell in Portland, Oregon. The McLeans live in Cedar Rapids and have family ties to Australia that began with an exchange student George's family hosted in 1960. Through the years, both families have visited each other's homelands. In the 1990s, their Australian friends arranged for the McLeans to see the Warlukulanga workshop, where the pieces are made, and Janelle fell in love with the spirit and the artistry there. She specializes in American regionalism and immediately recognized the parallel fascination with pattern between wood and the indigenous artists. You see it in these works. You see it in Grant Wood's work, especially his propensity to liking pattern, being drawn to pattern. You see it in so many works, she said, noting that she also observed the artistic lure of patterns when she and George lived in Alaska and France early in their marriage. That draw to pattern is a universal thing, she said. If a viewer didn't know the origin stories, McLean feels the Aboriginal pieces look like they could have been created by contemporary artists in New York, instead of mostly by women working on the ground, dipping sticks into acrylic paint half a world away. When you understand where they come from, it gives you all these levels of interest, she said. Aboriginal artists also weave stories into their designs. Outsiders are given just a surface explanation, but the meanings go much deeper for people living with these traditions. These story paintings are called dreamings. From what she's been told, McLean said the imagery often refers to the land, finding water, water holes, watching the movement of animals, as well as desert animals, and some rather gory scenes of snakes devouring their prey. You'll see animal footprints in a lot of these if you start looking, she said. The painting we bought when we were at the workshop, the woman artist told us, was all about a particular bird, whose name I cannot remember, who was trying to find a waterfall. Hunting is another theme, as the women typically hunt for eggs and the seed-bearing grasses that could grind into flour for sustenance while the men were away hunting for meat. The artist pointed out that little ovals inside circles signify eggs. Each painting has an accompanying story supplied by the artist. To see them, click on each painting posted at dreamings.squarespace.com/. McLean said the exhibit serves as a way to create both a virtual and safe in-person experience during this time of pandemic. It's almost like traveling around the world, she said. And at a glance, it's Dreamings, Australian Original Aboriginal Paintings. On the ground floor gallery, CRST Corporate Headquarters, 201 First Street Southeast. It'll be there through June 21st, view from the sidewalk, day or night. Open viewings are from 4 to 6 p.m. Wednesday or noon to 2, May 12th and 20th. Admission is free. For more information, call Janelle McLean at McLean Consulting, 319-270-0017. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette on Iris. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening. Have a great, safe day.
Are you among the millions of Americans living with chronic pain? If so, you may think prescription opioids are the solution. The truth is, the benefits of opioids are limited. Opioids only mask the pain. Opioids also come with serious side effects, ranging from nausea to withdrawal symptoms to overdose. As many as 25% of people who are prescribed opioids struggle with addiction. And those who are addicted to opioids are 40 times more likely to move on to heroin. No one wants to live in pain, but no one should put their health at risk to be pain-free. There is another choice, physical therapy. Physical therapists treat pain through movement and exercise, no warning labels required, and you get to be an active participant in your care. Choose to treat your pain safely. Choose physical therapy. Visit moveforwardpt.com to find a physical therapist near you. This public service announcement is brought to you by the American Physical Therapy Association.